Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Georgie, following from our discussion of hiring and setting the new employee up for success, what do we do when things don't go so right? If I'm assessing the situation and my option, if my employee's performance is lackluster, what do I do?
Well, John, I think it really depends on how long that person's been employed. So if someone is a fairly new employee, they've only been with you a few months and perhaps still in their probationary period, if their performance is not up to scratch at that point in time, sometimes that can be a pretty big red flag as to whether they're suitable for that role. It's not a legal requirement while that person has only been there a few months to formally performance manage them in terms of the potential unfair dismissal risk. And that's because employees are only protected from unfair dismissal if they have served a minimum employment period. For businesses with 15 or more employees, that is 6 months. But if they are considered to be a small business employer, which means they have fewer than 15 employees, then the minimum employment period is 12 months. So that's a really important threshold to bear in mind, because during the minimum employment period, that's when you're really assessing someone's suitability for the role. If in the early stages, there's a clear issue with that person's experience, skills, performance, it can be a real red flag as to whether that's the right person for the role. It's really worth considering whether you move beyond their probationary period for ongoing employment in that period, because if you terminate prior to the minimum employment period threshold, you don't have the risk of an unfair dismissal claim. So it's a bit more straightforward from a legal perspective.
Just to clarify before we go, I've got an employee. It's not working out either from a performance perspective or even potentially a cultural fit perspective. I've got less than 15 employees. So at any point to 12 months, I can terminate the employment without reason. Would that be fair?
Yeah, effectively without risk of an unfair dismissal claim. There are other protections that apply in that period. So there's also a theoretical risk of a general protections claim, and that's a regime where it's unlawful to dismiss on the basis of protected reasons such as a discriminatory attribute. So that could be race, gender, age, parental responsibilities and the like. And also if someone's exercised a workplace right. So if they had made a bullying complaint or they'd raised a query about underpayment, that sort of thing, that's a theoretical risk. And at that point in time, if you were terminating, whether it's due to performance, attitudes, those sorts of things, it's sometimes worth actually explaining the reason so that they don't then assume it was that other theoretical protected reason. But certainly from an unfair dismissal perspective, you don't have to have gone through a performance management process.
Right.
If they're not yet protected from unfair dismissal. So it's definitely worth bearing in mind. I often get asked whether the employer can extend their probationary period because the person has perhaps got close to the 6 month mark, their performance hasn't been great, and the employer says, oh, I really want to give them a further opportunity. Now, probation is a contractual issues under your employment contract. It might be built in that there's a 6 month probationary period, but that runs in parallel to the minimum employment period for the purposes of unfair dismissal. Even if you agree to extend probation, it won't change the statutory minimum employment period. So if you're not a small business employer and the minimum employment period is 6 months, once that employee ticks over 6 months, they're protected from unfair dismissal. But you have to bear that in mind. It's great if an employer wants to give an employee a bit more of a try and really wants to support them to improve, but you've also got to consider what the legal ramifications for doing so might be. There's a number of factors that come into play. And I've also had situations where people have performance managed during probation. Again, I think sometimes that can complicate things more than just making the difficult decision in probation, because employees are usually on their best behavior and doing their hardest in that period because they know their suitability is being assessed. If the writing's on the wall in that period, it might be a clear indication they're not the right fit for the role.
I'm not sure if you see it, but I see it amongst many business owners and clients that they actually want the employee to perform more than the employee wants to perform. They're really trying hard on behalf of the employee. They want to give them another chance. They've got the 5 months and they're thinking, oh, maybe things are going to improve. And the reality is, even at the 2 months and 3 weeks stage, if it's not working, it's not working.
That's right.
It's going to improve no matter what you put them through.
That's right. And that period really isn't a time for assessment for both the employee and the employer as to, is this the right place for that person? And if they're not trying their hardest in that period or not on their best behavior and really seeking to be engaged and prove their worth, I think that that's a real red flag. I completely understand that employers put a lot into recruitment and training and all those sorts of things. But during that first period, if it's not working out, it's probably a good indication it's not going to work out. Make the difficult decision early on because so my experience is both from a legal and practical perspective, it doesn't often get better beyond that period.
30-something years, I've seen one amazing turnaround out of thousands of employees. I guess on this, just on the topic of probationary periods, so what's good practice during the probationary period for an employer? I've often seen clients wake up one day and say, probationary period finishes for this employee tomorrow. What do we do? All of a sudden, we're having a decision. Should we continue or not? Surely there should be a more methodical process throughout the probationary period that gives both parties a chance to evaluate how they're going and so on.
And I think this really goes to the critical role of managers, people managers, leaders, to take a really intentional approach to the probationary period and their management more broadly beyond the probationary period. But think about it as, are there particular hurdles within that 6 months, if it was a 6 month probationary period, at the 1 month mark, let's have a check in with the employee, see how they're going. And it's less about, I'm going to provide all this formal feedback and pages of assessment, but it's more just really scheduling in those check ins. And so for the employee, they have an opportunity to say, hey, I don't know how this is supposed to be done or what have you, and ask questions. But the leader also has that trigger for thinking, okay, we're at 1 month in. How's this working out so far? Do I need to provide more support to that person? And how are they performing? And then maybe again at the 2 month or 3 month mark. And again, these are not formal meetings. It can just be, let's have a coffee and a chat. But it brings it to the forefront for that leader to be continuing to assess how things are going. It gives the employee an opportunity to have some support if they need it. And if that leader hadn't perhaps given them all the tools they needed to hit the ground running, it also keeps it in the forefront for the leader as to, is this the right person for the role? So if you get to the 3 months mark and think, we've had several discussions now, I feel like that person's been set up for success, but they're so far short, or there's been some behaviours that have been problematic already, you might be thinking, are we going to continue beyond that 3 month mark? But it also is much more likely then that if the person's getting towards the 6 month mark, then it will be very clear in that leader's mind, yes, this person is continuing beyond 6 months. Because if we're a day before 6 months and we're suddenly tearing around thinking, are we going to continue or not? I think you've left it pretty late at that point in time. And I've certainly been asked the one day before the probationary period expires, can we prepare a termination of employment letter and all those sorts of things? But you're far less likely to have panic and stress associated with that if you've taken a more intentional approach. There's absolutely the ability to move to terminate prior to that 6 month mark. You're not obliged to keep them employed up until that 6 month mark. Both from a practical and legal perspective, you're more likely to be well placed if you're taking that more methodical approach.
Yeah. And I think that the word intentional, I think, is really poignant. And I think for employers, one of the things they should do on day one of the employment is schedule those meetings with the employee so that they actually happen. Not rely on their memory for it to happen miraculously on the day that their probation expires. I have to remember one of my clients actually called you on the basis that it was a 6 month probationary period and they figured they could terminate the employee at 6 months and they got the date wrong by one day. And I'm sure that's happened with other people as well. And that started a protracted process that was unnecessary. And if they'd been intentional and methodical, they probably wouldn't have gotten past the 3 month mark. Being intentional, I think that's an excellent expression. So looking at it from the positive side, my employee's in place and I want this person to be part of my future. How do I help them live their using performance management? And what does performance management really mean?
Yeah, it's a really important consideration because I think often we think of performance management as a vehicle for exiting someone. But really going back to my comment that we invest so much in recruitment and training, you actually want to use performance management as a driver for someone being able to meet your expectations. One of the critical components of performance management is the employer being able to articulate what their concerns around performance are. Often what I see is that employers have this sense, gut feel, whatever you want to call it, it's not quite right, but they can't articulate it. And what that means is that the employee can't understand where they're falling short. It's really difficult to set that person up for improvement and ultimate success. Some of the key components are, firstly, what are the requirements of the role and making sure everyone's on the same page. And I think early on in employment relationships, usually there is consistency in understanding of what are the requirements. But in organizations that are growing rapidly, sometimes the requirements of the role can change as the organization grows and changes. So you need to come back to what are the requirements of the role. The second component is, what are the examples of where we have concerns that individual is not meeting our expectations, and providing examples. So it might be that there's three main areas that you're concerned about, but then actually providing examples of those, because they're far more likely to understand what those concerns are if they can see them. And ideally, those concerns wouldn't just be being raised, you know, 6-9 months down the track. They're things that you've had feedback provided in real time, and then we're getting to the point of formal performance management because those concerns have been continuing. So you provide those examples and then actually saying, this is what we need to see improvement in, and this is how we're going to support you to get there. And what that support looks like will really depend on the circumstances. It might be that person just needs to have more frequent check-ins with their manager. So it might be there's a meeting scheduled on a weekly basis where they'll discuss priorities. It might be that the person has trouble managing time. It's really about having discussions about how that could work. There might be some tools or technology that could help with that. It might be they need to undergo some additional training. And this can be particularly applicable where there has been a bit of a change in the role over time and the organization's changed a bit, and they really need to be upskilled because the organization sees a real future for them. So they give them some formal training, or it might be in-house training. I think it's really important, both on a practical level, giving that person the opportunity to improve by giving them the extra support, but also it shows you've adopted a fair approach from a legal perspective that will assist, and the employee will also, like, you genuinely want them to improve if you're actually giving them those tools for support. And psychologically, I'm obviously not a psychologist, but I think we can all understand or recognize that when someone feels that there is that genuine commitment to try and support someone to improve, they're far more likely to be engaged with the process. Yes. So those are some really key components, I think, to setting that person up for success in improving and meeting your expectations.
From a process perspective, do I need to formally document that process and have formal check-ins to see if they are actually improving and how that improvement's going?
Yeah, I think it's important from both a legal and practical perspective. Lawyers will always tell you have a document trail that will help if things don't work out as you'd hoped, if that person can't meet your expectations over a continuing period and you might be considering termination of employment, that will help from the perspective of showing that you gave them an opportunity to improve from an unfair dismissal perspective. But also on a practical level, I think firstly documenting the discussion that you've had, that initial performance management discussion, what those concerns were, examples, areas for improvement, and what support will be provided. Putting that all in documentary form is really important because these conversations are quite confronting for an employee to be a party to. And so it really helps distill it into paper form where they can then sit with that, review it, and really digest it. Because it might be as soon as the person started saying, we have concerns with your performance, it's all white noise after that point. So I think it's really worth having it in documentary form and actually setting out the period in which you're going to be considering whether they're improving. And usually that would be at least 4 weeks, but it might be longer if, for instance, you had concerns about them. If it's a sales role and their sales results are usually considered on a quarterly basis, for example, and you can't actually measure it prior to that, it doesn't make sense to make it a shorter period because you can't measure their improvement adequately in a shorter period. So actually setting out what is the period for review and when will those check-ins be? And so I think that is really important to manage expectations for the employee, but also give them some parameters to work within. They actually know what to expect and when they'll actually have an opportunity to have check-ins and those sorts of things. So I think that's really critical from a practical level of giving the employee a framework to work within.
And this is really consistent regardless of whether you want the person to succeed or whether or not you actually are tracking towards a termination process.
Yes, correct. If you set it up really well in terms of both your meetings as well as your paperwork, that will set you up to defend an unfair dismissal claim or any other sort of claim that might be made. One of the really critical components to that paperwork is that you're actually outlining what the implications might be if they're not lifting their performance. So you need to say that if you don't improve your performance to the expected standard within that review period, then your employment may be in jeopardy or result in termination of your employment. So you're putting them on notice. It's in effect a warning. And then if it gets to the end of that period and you're not satisfied there's been an adequate improvement and you move to termination of employment, having gone through that thorough and well-documented process will put you in good stead for defending any sort of claim.
I guess I'd be a bit sensitive if I'm trying to lift up an employee's performance because I can see a bright future for them. They've got all of the things apart from a few skills. I'd probably feel, maybe I'm a softie, I'd be disinclined. I'd be happy to document it, but not necessarily in the context of, and if you don't improve, then we'll shoot you. Whereas if I knew it was likely to head down the path of a dismissal, then I'd be more than happy to make it quite clear that there were consequences if we weren't able to get a satisfactory outcome. Obviously, that's up to the employer's perspective on that. But again, if they're not clear around the consequences of somebody not lifting their game, then it does expose them to perhaps a longer process, which results in conflict.
Yes. And I think if there hadn't been that warning component to the paperwork and the messaging, if it's because the employer very much wants to support that person to improve and is feeling very positive about that, it's less likely that at the end of 4 weeks, that was the period of review, that they're going to be at their wit's end where they're thinking, we can't do this anymore. So it might be at that point in time, as you say, protract the process, but you might at that point say, look, we still haven't seen that improvement. So we're going to extend, but if we don't see an improvement at the end, then it may result in the termination of your employment. But certainly if you're in that space that you're thinking, if this doesn't get better fairly, it's not a sustainable situation, then you do need to put that in. And I think it can really be one of those things that is critical in terms of managing the employee's expectations. If it's not in there, they might sort of see it as an opportunity for me to grow and build some skills, but my job's not on the line. So it can cut, you're far more likely to get it disputed if their expectations haven't been managed.
Okay, so we've gone through this process, or I've woken up one day and I'm certain that it's not going to work. So can I terminate? And what do I actually need to do to exit them from the business? What's good practice and what's required?
If you followed a good process in terms of performance management, you're at the end of the review period and then you wanted to deliver the decision that it hasn't worked out. From an unfair dismissal perspective, so if someone's protected from unfair dismissal, they've completed that minimum employment period and they earn less than the high income threshold, and that changes every year. It's currently just under 160,000 exclusive of super, so it's reasonably high. And also if someone's covered by an enterprise agreement or a modern award, irrespective of their remuneration, they can still be protected from unfair dismissal. If they're protected, you need to bear in mind procedural fairness in having that conversation about dismissal. You organise a meeting with the employee, give them the opportunity to have a support person present, and explain to them, we followed this performance management process. Unfortunately, we still have concerns. You articulate what those concerns are. And then you say, as a result, we've made the preliminary decision to terminate your employment. At that point, you give them an opportunity to respond. That opportunity is really critical as a measure of procedural fairness. Usually I suggest in this sort of context is that you then convene a short break for them to consider the response provided. If after the break you have decided that nothing changes your view, you can confirm the decision to terminate employment. Now,
can I restate that in my own words? So, Georgie, we've got through this performance management process and we've got concerns about your performance. I think that you're not delivering on this and this, which we started with the objectives or the requirements of the role. Our preliminary decision is that we're going to end the employment. Do I then ask for a response or do I say, let's take a 15-minute break so you can consider that and then provide a response? Which do I need to give them some time to reflect or do I ask for immediate response?
I think where there's been a performance management process, this shouldn't come as a shock to them. They're aware of your concerns prior. So I would deliver the preliminary decision, give them an opportunity to respond, and then you take the break where the employer considers their response, whether that changes the decision to terminate. In a lot of cases, it's not going to make a difference, but I've had cases occasionally where that person says, look, I haven't wanted to tell you, but I've actually been dealing with a very serious health diagnosis, something along those lines where the employer might decide to give them a further opportunity. But in most cases, at that point in time, where you followed a good performance management process, the writing's on the wall, it's not the right fit. And so they confirm the decision to terminate employment.
And just on that, because this is quite a sensitive matter, the employees are offered the opportunity to bring a support person. As the employer or the employer's representative, should they have somebody else with them as a witness of procedural fairness?
Yeah, it doesn't
record the interview with permission from the employee. How does the employer protect themselves from salacious claims that may come about?
It doesn't hurt to have another person present for the employer, and usually that would be another individual within the company. So depending on the size of the company, it might be the person's manager and then human resources. If it's a smaller company, it might just be two people from within the company. You need to bear in mind the dynamics. I've had suggestions before. We want three people from the company there. And then the employee says, I'm not bringing a support person. And then that starts to look a little bit heavy handed. So I think you've got to bear that in mind. But really, it's just someone there to take note. And it's worth preparing really well for that sort of meeting. So you've got a bit of a script. So that person knows exactly what they're going to be saying. It's really about making a note of what the employee said in response and those sorts of things. In terms of whether it's recorded, I don't usually suggest that these meetings are recorded. I think that can change the dynamics when people know that it is being recorded. From an employee's perspective, if the meeting is being recorded, they're already thinking, why does it need to be recorded? What's in the background here that perhaps the employer knows they're doing something wrong and so they're trying to record the meetings? I wouldn't suggest it. If the employee says they want to record it, don't have to agree. But if the employee is approaching it and saying, I want to record it, then maybe the employer does as well, just so that you both have a copy. Otherwise, I think doing it unrecorded is probably the ideal situation.
And just from a terminology perspective, when you decide to that the employment will cease, what exactly do you say? I mean, terminate sounds like pistols at 12 paces. So what is the appropriate terminology?
Look, termination of employment. I think it's important to note you don't deliver the message as we've decided to terminate you, because it's the employment that's being terminated, not the individual. The legislation uses the word dismiss, but I think that sounds even harsher because it sounds quite flippant that you're dismissing that person. So I think we've decided to terminate or to end your employment on the basis that we haven't been able to meet our performance expectations. I think that's probably the best way. And I think it's always important to use direct language, because if sometimes you beat around the bush or try and use the implications of what you're saying can be lost, and then there's confusion about that, and that could potentially undermine procedural fairness, but also just make a little bit more challenge in terms of moving forward because the employee doesn't understand what the messaging has been.
Sure. the three strikes rule. Is that real or is that only for big companies?
Well, that's a bit of an HR urban myth. It's never been enshrined in legislation. Occasionally you see it in a workplace policy. So if there's a workplace policy in place that requires three strike in performance management before the employer is able to move to termination, that can present some procedural fairness issues if the employer moves earlier. And there's certainly ways that you can try and overcome that, but I would recommend someone gets advice before pulling the pin. But certainly it doesn't need to be in your policy. And sometimes employers will say, I just want to refresh my policies. Can you have a look? And I see it in there and I say that needs to come out because it really doesn't give the flexibility to performance manage in the appropriate way. If you've got someone who's got really clear shortcomings in terms of their performance and you think we're probably not going to be able to lift it, you don't want to have to go through three warnings because that's going to become protracted. That person will become increasingly disengaged and there are further legal risks that can arise during that performance improvement process. Occasionally you see in enterprise agreements, particularly in highly unionized environments, that there can be more warnings required in a disciplinary process. That tends to be more about conduct rather than performance. And where it's in the enterprise agreement, that is holding it to an even higher threshold in terms of needing to comply with it. So you need to bear that in mind as well. But the approach really is if you've done one warning and a good performance improvement process or performance management process, then there's no requirement to issue further warnings if they're unable to improve during that first reasonable period.
So what if they seem depressed or they have got a bunch of stuff going on outside the office? I don't want to cross the line. I want to be supportive, but I also have got a business to run and I can't afford to pay for non-performers. Am I being unreasonable to terminate the employment, and what should I do?
I think it will depend on a number of factors, including that person's length of service. If they're a long-standing employee, they've previously been a really good performer, but it's dropped off and it's because of something significant in their personal life. If you weigh up the recruitment retraining costs against providing short-term support to get that person back on track, it might be worth trying to support that person to improve. But at the end of the day, employers that are seeking to run a business or an organisation, it is a real practical hurdle for someone to improve their performance if they have issues going on in their personal life and they might need to be borne in mind. You don't have to necessarily ask lots of questions about it. But if on a practical level you want that person to improve, but you're aware that they're probably not themselves, you probably do want to ask some respectful questions and just say, I've noticed you're not yourself. Is there anything you want to make us aware of? Do you need support with anything? And that's not to say the employer then becomes responsible for fixing that person's personal matters. But if they're able to direct them to an employee assistance program or some sort of support to enable that person to improve, you're far more likely to get traction. And I think on a longer term view, that person, if they've received supports, far more likely to be engaged and loyal to the organisation. So there's no one-size-fits-all approach, but I think you're just going to bear those things in mind. And I think also if you respond to any of those issues in a very black and white manner and say, well, that's not my problem, we need this from you, you probably heighten your legal risk to either a workers' comp claim or a general protections claim. Yeah, it's got to be managed fairly delicately.
Yeah. So I mentioned that it'd be good for them to lift their game and all of a sudden I've got a claim for bullying, stress, sexual harassment, spreading COVID, 5G installations. What do I do now?
Sometimes employers can get a little bit or feel a bit hamstrung just because an employee said, well, they've tried to deflect responsibility by pointing the finger at the employer or the manager. How you respond, depending on what they've raised, will depend on the circumstances. So if an employee says, well, you've bullied me in that performance management meeting. Bullying under the legal definition is repeated unreasonable behaviour. So one meeting can't amount to bullying. You still want to consider, has there been any unreasonable behaviour in that meeting? But that doesn't mean they are a protected species and you can't continue with the performance management. You have to deal with whatever's been raised in an appropriate way. And certainly if someone was raising concerns about inappropriate behaviour, sexual harassment, you want to be shown to be actually considering those things, but also continuing with the performance management plan in parallel. If someone makes a workers' compensation claim and they put in a certificate of capacity saying they have no capacity for work, that becomes a more involved process because there are obligations under workers' compensation legislation to provide suitable employment for a particular period in Victoria. That's 52 weeks if the claim is accepted. In the short term, if they say, oh, I've been unreasonably performance managed, you want to be able to demonstrate to your workers' comp agent that it was reasonable management action taken on reasonable grounds. And if you're able to demonstrate that, then there's a good chance the workers' comp claim won't be accepted because it falls within that exception of reasonable management action. So this really, I think, underscores the importance that managers and leaders who are carrying out performance management understand the importance of this reasonable management action. They know what the potential risks can be, the legal implications, and they know practically what do I need to do in these discussions to ensure that I'm getting the message across, but that I'm not, you know, potentially giving rise to these sorts of legal risks. So I think that's how you manage the legal risks. If the employee has a workers' comp claim rejected, it's going to be challenging to try and get that person personally back into the workplace, but also to reasonably engage in the performance improvement process. But really, you've just got to continue on the basis that, well, that hasn't been accepted. So performance improvement continues. We're satisfied it's reasonable management action as long as you're satisfied that person has capacity for work based on the medical evidence. You can continue on. Being said, there can be some practical implications about whether the relationship can continue. It's always worth getting advice in these situations because there are a lot of moving parts. The take-home message, other than reasonable management action, is that just because an employee pushes back and becomes defensive about performance management doesn't mean that you can't continue with that process, provided you've addressed the concerns that have been raised.
So this concept of reasonable management action, what does that really mean?
Well, I think the law absolutely recognises that an employer has the ability to provide feedback around work, to issue directions around work, provided that they're delivered in a reasonable manner. So really that's about just delivering information in a respectful manner. I think direct is important as long as it's still courteous and professional. You often hear the adage that clear is kind, and I absolutely subscribe to that. So while it can be difficult for leaders to sort of say, I have concerns with these aspects of your performance, if sugarcoat it or try and, I guess, water it down, you're far less likely to get that traction, and also potentially the uncertainty could be unreasonable as well. So you actually want to be very clear about what you're saying. Give that employee an opportunity to say their piece. And it doesn't mean that changes the direction of the performance management, but on a practical level, they feel like they've been heard. And, you know, you give examples, you commit it to writing, all those sorts of things that we've already discussed. That's all considered reasonable management action. If the person was, you know, aggressive in the way that they provided the feedback, or they were saying you're not meeting these aspects of our expected standards of performance that actually relate to an entirely different role, or, you know, there's uncertainty around what the role requires, all those sorts of things start to look more like unreasonable management actions. So I think clarity is really key, and just being professional in the way that the feedback is delivered to the employee.
Okay. So now, just on that, this clarity is highly desirable. What I've seen with many organizations, that as they've grown, the requirements of the job have changed. A person's role has changed. The skills that they need may change. And, you know, while the work's being done, no one really seems to make any efforts to update job descriptions or HR policies or any of these things until, of course, it goes to custody. So is there a... is it appropriate, and how does one do it, to actually go about saying, okay, well, hang on, John's job description has changed and we need to formally document that. And how do we get John on board with this process, or do we just tell him it's changed and too bad, so sad? What's the process there, Georgie?
Yeah, I think there's a few components. The first is ideally in, you know, going back to our discussion from last time around what's in your employment contract, having provision in there that sort of says, you know, this is the role and this is a bit of a summary of duty and responsibilities, but, you know, you may be required to undertake additional duties and responsibilities that are within your skill and competence. And, you know, the employment contract continues to apply. And that's particularly important in those sorts of organizations, you know, startups or employers who are likely to grow rapidly, because there will be a sort of a blurring of the boundaries of different roles and responsibilities. But I think then in parallel, you want to have good management of performance. Now, this is distinct from performance management. Management of performance is the day-to-day role that leaders and people managers perform. And that's really about giving feedback, giving direction around work, those sorts of things, and having regular conversations. So ideally, we will have at a certain point in time got to the point where we realize the scope of the roles changed slightly. So you have a conversation about it. Now, if you document it, fabulous. But if you don't, at least there needs to be, you know, a record made of that, or, you know, an email sent so that it confirms everyone's on the same page that, you know, there's been a bit of a change, but otherwise everything continues as normal. Now, if there hasn't been that sort of infrastructure in place where you haven't really had a discussion about the change in the role, and the employee doesn't think that a number of new aspects are part of their role, it's not reflected in their employment contract, there haven't been discussions around it, you do run the risk that the employee might say, well, if you say now that's my role, then what about my old role? Is that redundant? And depending if they're committed to the organization or not, there could be a discussion around redundancy and having to try and work around that. So if there's a substantial change to the role, that could be a risk. If it's just an adding of certain components as the organization grows, I think it's less risky, but you also want to bear in mind the person's far less likely to come with you on that journey unless you give them that opportunity to grow into that role, because that's not the role that they were employed to do. So yeah, I think it's about giving them that opportunity. Now, occasionally what happens is that the organization grows and you've wanted that person to grow with the role, but it hasn't happened. And at that point in time, you know, that then becomes about, well, this is what the organization needs and they're unable to meet that. So then you look at either performance management, or if it's a substantial change because the role has grown substantially and changed substantially, then it might trigger a redundancy. So it's just, again, going back to that intentional piece. It's not just set and forget. You have to keep considering, well, what are all of our employees doing? Has there been any changes? If so, let's have a chat about it so that everyone's on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That sounds much clearer. And you mentioned before performance versus conduct. How do you distinguish the two as reasons, perhaps either behavioral modification or termination of the employment?
Yeah, really important distinction. Now, these are not legal terms. They're not defined in the Fair Work Act, but performance is really about, is the person doing what is required of them from a day-to-day perspective in their role? And so you look at what are the key performance indicators, if they've been distilled, those sorts of things. Conduct is more around someone's behavior. So it could be, you know, sometimes it's attitudes, but it could be the way they behave in terms of other employees. They might not be respectful. They might be getting so serious that it's actually breaching, you know, your policies and procedures around appropriate workplace behavior. Sometimes they're overlapping though. There might be performance and conduct issues. So you do actually need to sort of delineate and say, well, these are the performance issues, these are the conduct issues. And still, you know, if they're lower level issues that you want to be improved, you need to identify those and say, we need these to be improved. And if we don't see an improvement, you know, that could result in termination of the employment. The really critical piece with conduct, though, is that in some cases, conduct or misconduct, a failure to adhere to the behavioral standards, may justify termination of employment without going through that improvement process or warning process. Sometimes the conduct will be so serious that we'll actually meet the threshold of serious misconduct. So things like fraud, theft, sexual harassment, those sorts of things can justify immediate dismissal without notice in some cases. it's a high threshold. It's certainly that is a possibility. And other times it might be that it's not meeting the threshold of serious misconduct, but it's conduct that's serious enough that you just think we can't allow this person to continue to work in our organization. So it justifies the termination of their employment. And in that case, you might provide payment in lieu of notice, but you still terminate without going through a warning process. So again, you know, conduct is really something that you have to consider in its particular circumstances. If someone is a new employee and they mouth off at their manager in a really inappropriate way, you might sort of think, well, this is not the sort of standard that we aspire to. So that's not the right person for our workplace culture. But if you've got a long-standing employee who mouths off at their manager and that's really out of character, they've got an unblemished employment record, you might sort of think, well, maybe that's a situation where we issue a warning and we might also want to have a discussion with them to say, hey, is something else going on? Because that's really out of character for you. So I think both on a practical level, but in terms of managing legal risk, if you've got a long-standing member of staff who does something that's lower level misconduct, there might be an opportunity there to, you know, give them an opportunity to pull up their socks. But, you know, each situation in its own context. And while there is legal risk associated with lower level misconduct dismissal for a long-standing member of staff, because their long service will, you know, potentially impact the harshness of the dismissal in an unfair dismissal context, you also sometimes have to think about the broader context. And if something that they've done has had an impact on working relationships and it's caused you to lose trust in them or whatever it might be, then sometimes you have to take on that potential legal risk because of all the other risks that are associated with keeping them in the organization.
Is performance management my only option?
In terms of moving to dismissal earlier, no, it's not your only option. It's the less risky option, I guess, from an unfair dismissal perspective. But sometimes I'll have a client come to me and they say, look, this person's not been performing for ages. Nothing's been done about it. They have to go now. We've made the decision. It's become really, you know, fractious, or other people are threatening to resign or whatever it might. Again, in that case, you've got a reasonable risk of an unfair dismissal claim if they're protected from unfair dismissal because you haven't gone through performance management, you haven't put them on notice that their employment may be in jeopardy. But you've got a whole lot of other legal risks and practical risks. You might have someone who's saying, well, I've had to pick up all the slack, I'm now overburdened, I'm going to make a workers' comp claim. You might have other people saying they're going to leave, those sorts of things. In that case, sometimes you have to take on that risk of a potential unfair dismissal claim in order to protect your broader working environment and your other staff. What I usually suggest in that circumstance is you consider whether you can make an agreement around a mutual separation with that employee. So what you can look at doing is saying, you know, we've got these concerns about your performance. We could go through a performance management process with you, but we're concerned that you won't get there. And we've got concerns about the broader working environment. We've just reached a decision that it's an untenable situation. So we've decided to terminate your employment. But then you say, you know, we're prepared to offer you something over and above your legal entitlements in exchange for you signing a deed of release, which effectively says that your departure was amicable. And what I suggest in those circumstances is you consider offering something around the 4-week mark. Because had you continued to employ that person and performance managed them, they might have been with you for a further 4 weeks. And if their performance really is substandard, then a lot of the time that is kind of the extent of your legal risk if they were to run an unfair dismissal claim, because the commission will look at how long would their employment have continued if you performance managed them, you know, adequately. So, and, you know, that can become a bit of a negotiation. They may try and negotiate further. But, you know, if they do make an agreement with you, then the deed of release will prevent them from making post-termination claims. Yeah. And I think sometimes employers think that an unfair dismissal claim is the worst thing in the world. And obviously, we'd like to avoid them as much as possible. But, you know, there are risks in terms of keeping that person employed. And it might be that if it is a really fractious relationship and you try and performance manage, they might then try and make a bullying complaint or a workers' comp claim. And so, you know, it does become far more complicated. So sometimes it's better to make the decision, manage, you know, the dismissal, if it, unfair dismissal claim, if it comes, you know, noting that there's an opportunity to try and resolve it at conciliation. But you've got to consider your broader operational requirements and the risks for your other employees who are continuing to work with the organization.
Yeah. Yeah. And somebody mentioned to me this concept of constructive dismissal. What's that?
So constructive dismissal is effectively where an employee feels that they have no option to resign on the basis of a course of conduct undertaken by the employer. So usually an employee can only make an unfair dismissal claim or a general protections claim involving dismissal if they have been dismissed at the initiative of the employer. So the employer has said, I'm terminating your employment. If the employee resigns, however, and they say, I was forced to resign because my employer, you know, treated me so poorly, or, you know, that I was subjected to bullying and I had to leave and the employer knew about it and did nothing about it or something along those lines, then sometimes the Fair Work Commission will accept that it is a constructive dismissal that in effect makes it a dismissal at the employer's initiative. And so then they can hear the unfair dismissal claim. So if someone makes, if they resign their employment and then they make an unfair dismissal claim, there's the opportunity for the employer to raise a jurisdictional objection, and say, you know, the commission has no jurisdiction to hear this because the employee resigned. But in that context, if there was, you know, a really challenging set of circumstances leading up to that resignation, there is a chance that the commission might say, well, we will hear that that unfair dismissal claim because we're satisfied it was in effect a dismissal at the initiative of the employer. So it's something worth bearing in mind. But usually if, you know, we're taking that intentional approach in terms of management of our employees, whether it's formal performance management or just management in general, hopefully you won't get into circumstances where an employee thinks that they've been forced to resign.
Yep. Yep. And I guess coming to the final question then, so we've gone through a process where we've spoken to the employee and we terminated the employment. What's good practice from there? Do you provide them with a brown paper bag and they get to put their stuff in it and leave immediately under guard and security? Or do we do something else? What's actually good practice?
Yeah, look, again, this depends on the circumstances. If it's performance management and it's been a reasonably short relationship, it might be that, you know, you don't have to consider allowing them to say goodbye to their co-workers and all that sort of thing. So it might be that they just effectively collect their belongings and they leave and they're able to, you know, go back to their desk or office or workstation. Other times there might be concern that that employee will, for want of a better term, go nuclear and want to go back and, you know, start saying things to their co-workers, or they might want to, you know, cause some sort of damage on their way out. If that's the case, then the employer has the right to protect its own property and its relationships with its other employees. And so they can say, look, we'll arrange to pack up your personal belongings and send them to you and that sort of thing. So it really depends on the circumstances. And we've seen this play out a lot during the COVID-19 pandemic where people are working remotely and how do we do that, you know, handover of property. And sometimes the employee themselves has some fairly high value items of property. Maybe it's, you know, laptop, phone, whatever else, it might even be a vehicle. So you need to consider how that's going to be effectively handed over. So yeah, consideration needs to be given to how that employee is likely to respond. In most cases, you would hope that an employee, while very disappointed, will just, you know, go off and do the right thing. But if it's a situation where it's a long-standing member of staff who's had a substantial contribution to the organisation, and unfortunately there's been issues with their performance, you haven't been able to support them to improve, you still might, you know, have a discussion with them about how they'd like it to be communicated so that they can leave with dignity. And there might even be like a function or some sort of communication that goes to staff about their departure. And doing that, I think, can practically lessen the impact in terms of potential unfair dismissal claim because they feel like it's been well managed. It also helps the people who are left behind because if there's a longstanding member of staff, they might feel like, well, that person's just disappeared. What was that about? And am I next? So I think these things do need to be well thought through, but it will depend on, you know, a number of factors. And really important is to confirm the decision in a termination letter that's issued to the employee. And, you know, that can either be issued to them after the meeting. And I always suggest you don't go to the termination meeting with the letter there because then it effectively a predetermined outcome, which can impact procedural fairness. But it does need to be there and it should really set out clearly the reason for dismissal and, you know, summarising the process that's been followed. Because what we always suggest is it's giving the employee the information they need to understand the decision, but also if that letter was then to go to a plaintiff law firm, you know, for a potential unfair dismissal, you've got your defence to an unfair dismissal claim really well documented in that letter. So worth having your paperwork really carefully together as well.
And what about notice periods? Is there a notice period when you dismiss somebody or do you?
Yeah, so if it's termination for underperformance, then someone will be entitled to notice of termination. If you've gone through a performance improvement process, they haven't met your expectations. In most cases, employers will pay in lieu of notice at that point in time, unless they want the employee to do a short handover afterwards. But you always have to bear in mind the risk of if they're disgruntled, that can then lead to, you know, further issues. So often it will be payment in lieu of notice, but certainly termination for that reason entitles the employee to notice or payment in lieu. If it's misconduct, however, if it meets that threshold of serious misconduct, then, you know, they're not entitled to notice. But again, that is a really high bar. So if you're considering termination for that reason, it's worth getting some advice.
But good. Anything else we need to cover?
I think so. I think it's just always worth trying to start these processes in your mind early as an employer or as a leader. Hopefully not just letting things fester until you reach that critical point and thinking that person has to go, because at that point in time, you're probably making more work for yourself, even though it feels like work having to go through the processes leading up to that point. But I think it's always worth getting advice at an early stage, because sometimes if you wait until things have really imploded, then the legal and practical risks are higher. Whereas if you get some advice at an early stage, often you can manage it quite effectively yourselves without it ending up in some sort of legal dispute. And so it will actually save you some time and money in the future.
Yeah. Totally agree with that. And again, I come back to that intentional management construct that you describe. And I guess that sort of raises in my mind, there's very few managers, I believe, who have gone through a training or an education process themselves of how to deal with these sorts of HR issues and their obligations and responsibilities of as leaders and managers. Where can they go to get that sort of upskilling? Is this just something that they need to read in the HR policies and hope for the best?
Yeah, I think it's always worth investing in your managers, because really you want them to be getting the best out of your people. And if you're just relying on them to read a policy manual, it's less likely to actually happen in the first instance. And secondly, it probably won't leave a lasting impact on them. So I think investing in their upskilling and their training is really important. And there's lots of different ways of doing that. I think absolutely there's a place for training that allows them to understand the legal framework. And we run performance management versus managing performance training that really outlines, you know, what is that day-to-day role of managers and people leaders, when it becomes performance management, you know, what does that require? What are the legal risks and how do you practically manage that? And, you know, ideally these sorts of trainings need to be really interactive so that they can ask questions, have an opportunity to engage in case studies and those sorts of things. So then it really does leave that lasting impact. So if they're in that situation that they think they need to start performance managing, you know, there's some little red flags or alarm bells going off in their head of the things that they need to consider, and hopefully then be able to manage that process. Or if they need to get support from HR or external legal advice, they'll be able to manage that in that really intentional way.
Yeah.
So I think it's absolutely worth investing in that sort of training for your managers so that they are set up for success and hopefully can limit the risks of further legal action.
Mm, yeah, all the way through this discussion today, it's been really obvious to me that the decisions that are being made about performance, about meeting the skill requirements, about improving the performance, whilst it sounds easy that these be documented and be objective, a lot of the discussion is actually quite subjective.
Yes.
When we're talking about conduct and unreasonable conduct, you know, it's again quite subjective. And so I think it'd be absolutely vital that managers and leaders be able to tap into training that would help them see some examples of what's inappropriate conduct as opposed to untenable conduct. So
yes.
Good. All right. Well, look, Georgie, thank you so much for that. I feel much clearer on the issues around termination, which is a relief. And I look forward to our next discussion.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, John.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe where you listen to podcasts, follow us on LinkedIn for more insights, and share the show with other business leaders. Stay focused and take action.